most essential feature of capitalism, micro-usury. People believe capitalism. Only run words together, or maybe my thing is the profit-driven ethic. Okay, but the system of private banking debt money is capitalism's most essential feature, and completely missing from the study and definition of capitalism. Macro usury is a misuse of the money creation power and regulatory system, the most essential feature of capitalism's micro usury. Is that it? Is that all I needed to read?
What's the source there? Is that Lincoln, or I just read it a couple of days ago?
Esquivel.
Well, who's he quoting there?
I don't know.
Cook, the writer of the book I was reading?
That's Martin.
I think he's just saying this. Yeah, he uses his own words.
That's Martin. My thought is not to use the word macro usury. Here, people are already confused about capitalism, that word.
Oh.
Now we're introducing another word that they don't know.
A technical phrase that, they're all English words, but we don't know what they mean.
So I think that the content is really important. But I wanted to say to Martin, I don't think we should introduce a new word that people can again be confused by.
Just say interest.
No, let me say. The most essential feature of capitalism is the private banking debt money system. Something like that. Is the creation of money by private banks. That's pretty simple, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's what he's trying to say here. This essential feature, this root of the system, capitalism, is completely missing from the study and definition of capitalism, because of why?
You have the book here?
Let's try it.
Hold on. This point is critical. In order to reach, this is what we're doing in trying to reach progressives who think capitalism, profit, but they don't see the engine of it.
Well, this is what I wrote. Just a second, I'll send it to you.
I forget what the same words were.
But the system of private banking debt money is capitalism's most essential feature and completely missing from the study and definition of capitalism, and maybe like understanding of capitalism. This is usury and is a misuse of the money creation power and regulatory system. This is usury.
Martin has just arrived.
Hi, it's Martin.
Hi, Martin.
Turn the light on over there so they can see. No, right here. Right over here.
You said to give this book to Michael when you finish. You didn't get
it.
That's right.
Who's Michael?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Martin Morton.
Huh.
Okay, now we're complete.
Let's not let Martin get... Hi, there he is.
Hi there.
Hey, greetings, folks.
The first thing we're doing is talking about your new theme, which I think is critical. I think it's just critical.
Did you get my email earlier today?
Yes, I shared it with Will.
Yeah.
My thought is not to introduce a new word like macro usury that people will get confused by, and keep it much simpler. And Will, why don't you read what you?
Okay. The most essential feature of capitalism is the creation of money by private banks and their charging of interest for the money they create. People believe capitalism is the profit-driven ethic, but the system of private banking, debt money, is capitalism's most essential feature and completely missing from the study and definition of capitalism. This is usury and is a misuse of the money creation power and regulatory system.
I would say without debt money, it's not capitalism.
I believe that those words...
Can I just interrupt? Maureen, can you say louder what you just said?
I would suggest that without debt money, what we have is not capitalism, if we're calling the present system that we have capitalism.
Do you want to add that at the end?
Well, let me just talk about it briefly.
Okay.
Steve Keen has shown in his economic modeling that if you don't have debt money, you have a system that's actually relatively stable and quite equitable. If we have debt money, we have a system that's wildly unstable and very unjust. That's chalk and cheese. And if you're calling what we have now, if one's calling what we have now capitalism, then if we take out debt money, I would suggest that is not capitalism.
What's not capitalism? After the debt money's taken out or before the debt money's taken out?
If you're calling what we have now capitalism, then if we take debt money out, we have something that looks very different and behaves very differently. So, and it's not capitalism. It resembles Adam Smith's false definition of capitalism, but it's not really capitalism.
With debt money taken out.
Yeah.
Have you been reading a book by Richard C. Cook? Or have you read his book called We Hold These Truths?
No.
See, now it's in the picture.
Okay, sorry.
That's okay.
That's the book. And if the words that you're using, I think, are in the first five chapters. And I haven't found them yet. But I've been reading the book and I remember the words. In fact, there's a definition of capitalism somewhere in here.
Is it in the index? Is it in the index?
Maybe.
So maybe he's the second person that identifies capitalism as the private debt money system.
Uh-huh.
Maybe. Don's looking in the book.
Oh, gee. Capitalism, 23. I'm 53. Well, let's look. That's not where I saw.
I think it's an important point, and especially if people want to reach out to all these progressive groups who think capitalism but know nothing about the money system. You know? I think it's key. I was trying to do that in the Two Left Forum panels with people, you know, to try to say, hey, this is the system, but they don't tell you about the money. But I didn't. It would be good if I had had a slide that said exactly this at the beginning, to make people sit up and think.
Well, Stephen Zweig says we're not trying to do away with capitalism, but yeah, we are.
What's the other word people use? The good capitalism, they call it private enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
The private enterprise system. Yeah. Profit's not bad. Someone said that historically, that profit, it wasn't profit that was bad.
Losing money's bad.
Losing money.
Yeah.
So, could we... The most essential feature of capitalism is the creation of money. You know, oh, this is the other thing. The creation of money by private banks and their charging of interest. Do you think that in terms of the root cause, it's also the interest?
What was the question?
Well,
the question was, is it the private creation of money that's the root cause, or is it the private creation of money and charging interest for it?
It's the private creation of money, because it misallocates the money. We don't have, the bankers have control of where the money goes. We want control of it through Congress.
But I would suggest there's also macro usury in the way that the bankers nowadays have arranged things, so they don't take risks when they don't lend out money. In other words, go back to the medieval scholastics. The bankers had to take on risks inherent in lending out money. They were limited in under the conditions under which they could actually lend their money. The fact that those conditions have completely gone by the board in terms of and actually get us prisoners now people back in hand, so I think is also a misuse of the money system. It's not so much that they're actually charging interest, it's the fact that they're taking, they demand their pound of flesh without taking any risks.
And they have no risk.
That is macro news.
Sorry to interrupt it.
Oh, well, let's, what Martin said, this last thing, Martin, and you said, can we add it to what Will has here? Oh, what about the interest? Do we want to take the interest out and just leave what we just talked about? Private creation of money and what was, and the misuse of it? Is that what you said, Martin? I'm trying to remember.
I don't know what
did
I say.
Yeah, right there. It's, well, what did you say?
Well, Martin
I dropped the word most because I actually think the essential feature of capitalism is without that, it's not capitalism. If we're calling what we have now capitalism.
So how would you change that first sentence? And Will, could you write what Martin says so we can...
Right here. I don't know. That's just something I printed up from that.
So what do I...
I took out macro usury.
Why don't you read it out loud? Slowly.
Which one? The one Martin wrote without revision?
No, the one you did without the word macro usury.
Yeah, the most essential feature of capitalism is the creation of money by private banks and their charging of interest for the money they create.
So stop right there. So Martin, you had said, I had brought up the question about do we need the interest, and I thought you had said no, but you had added something.
Well, I think it's, I mean, I would think, and I think the medieval scholastics thought, that it's entirely reasonable for banks to charge interest when the banks themselves are either co-participating in the activity that they're loaning the money for, or take on some risk.
Yep.
From the individual, just like the medieval scholars. Without that, so I don't think it's interest per se. I think it's the way that the banks have changed. I mean, Stephen says modern capitalism goes back to Holland and the Netherlands. And what was the thing that really happened in the Netherlands? The thing that really happened in the Netherlands was, because of the Protestant Reformation, the prohibition against usury, as the medieval scholastics defined it, was dropped. And so the banks could go berserk.
Well, that's not my understanding of what happened in the Netherlands. I mean,
there was other stuff in the Netherlands too.
I'm thinking the Bank of Amsterdam, which was supposed to be a deposit institution, but was secretly creating money by making these loans.
Yes.
So that's the private creation of money.
Yeah, but that's not really a new thing, even though they weren't supposed to be doing that, because banks before the Dutch were also doing that. If you go back to Venice, they were actually creating money too.
Right.
For me, the thing that really changed with Holland, was not necessarily that the Bank of Amsterdam was actually creating money, but that the scholastic limitations on the way that on the situations and conditions and the way that banks made loans changed.
Right, but I don't remember having studied anything about the Holland banking system with Amsterdam. I don't remember. We talked about the stock market.
It goes into the way the Calvinists dropped the prohibitions against usury.
Yes.
Yeah, they were blessed by God because they were all very making a lot of money. It was proof that God was on their side.
I mean, for me, modern capitalism is the confluence of the creation of fractional reserve banking, along with the dropping of all the limitations on usury.
I'm not clear on when capitalism as defined as you're defining him started.
Well, Stephen says that's what in his opinion capitalism really started. I mean, it's essentially the title of the chapter. The book floating around. He talks about it, the rise of capitalism in Amsterdam. That's the title of the chapter. And then he talks about transferring capitalism to England, which is implying that England was not yet a capitalist country, even though they had banks which created money.
Right.
So, it's to me, the way that I think about it is that capitalism is the confluence of the banks creating money, and then the and then all the limitations being taken off them, under the conditions in which they could.
The conditions to which they what?
The conditions under which they could were permitted to loan money were taken off them.
Huh.
In other words, the scholastic prohibitions.
Ah.
Against usury.
And that's, is that the riskless, that they don't take risk?
Yeah. And basically, they're free to loan money under conditions in which they don't take risks or take an active part in the enterprise in which they're funded.
Okay. Huh. Okay.
I mean, that's how I understand capitalism. Particularly, I've come to understand capitalism since we've gone through Stephen's book and gone through your presentation.
Well, the thing about Holland that I remember was that it became the way of, well, it's interesting. I guess I don't remember that much about that chapter. I remember the stock market. I remember that. I remember that Holland became the center of commerce of Europe.
Yeah.
And that was major.
Yeah.
You know. But they had that, secretly they were loaning money to the Dutch East India Company that was bringing in the gold and sending it, the silver, and sending it in their ships to India and bringing back the gold. Right? Wasn't that the way that worked?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that gold-silver trade that they controlled.
Yes. Which itself is macro-user.
Yeah. Misuse of the money system, right?
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, do you want one of us to take take another shot at this? And because I want to put it at the end of, I think you should do it, Martin, and we'll put it at the end of the last chapter. Maybe we'll put it as, you know what, we'll put it separately as an epilogue, because it's that important, I think.
And use his words.
Use Martin's
macro-usury.
Whatever Martin wants to use. Whatever he wants to use.
Yeah.
He'll use it. Because
yeah.
it's gonna encourage me to go.
I'm feeling the responsibility.
Yeah. Well, don't feel it.
What do you say?
I was joking that I'm feeling the responsibility of.
Great.
So Zarlinga's word, is macro usury, right?
Macro or micro?
Macro.
Macro, yeah.
Macro usury.
Oh, yeah.
The other thing I wanted to talk about at our little celebration, Don and I are having tea and muffins.
Okay.
What are you guys having?
The hard liquor.
I had a cup of coffee. He's got something over here. A bottle.
Oh, I just have water.
Ah, okay.
Rye.
Okay.
Yeah, rye.
Rye, yes.
The thing I wrote down was, and take a moment to think about this, when you think about our class, what are the things that for you were the most important things to realize, just for you personally?
Inefficiency and waste.
Well, one of the most important things for me to realize, and it blew me away when we discussed it, was that the Dark Ages was in fact the mother of all depressions caused by a shortage of money. Because Byzantium was hoarding all the gold. It was keeping the Western Europe in a state of economic subjugation to the point that they lost the teachings of people like Aristotle.
There's another profound thing. We have to put that in the back of the book. At the back of the class. You didn't listen? You didn't listen?
No.
Oh, Don wasn't listening. He's looking in this book trying to find macro usury. Can you say it again, Morton, for Don's sake?
Oh, okay. Well, I think one of the most profound things for me, and it shows just how important the money system is the way that when we learn that the Dark Ages, in fact, the mother of all depressions, caused by a shortage of money, because Byzantium was hoarding all the money, all the gold. I mean, to the point. I mean, this blows me away. It was and it lasted for hundreds of years, and it was a depression to the point that they actually lost all knowledge of Aristotle. Didn't rediscover
the
game until the Reformation.
Okay. The Dark Age is the mother of all depressions because of the lack of money caused by...
by Byzantium hoarding all the gold.
It is pretty profound, isn't it?
I mean, it's a depression that lasted for 200 years. I mean, Europe always went back to a watery continent. Or in Western Europe.
200 years.
Wow. How important Stephen's themes are, right?
Yeah. I didn't know how to spell Byzantium. I'm just trying to quote what Martin said. Dark Ages were all depression because the lack of money caused him hoarding all the gold.
I mean, the depression was so that they lost all knowledge of Aristotle. Okay. I mean, that's incredible.
It's a depression. Yes.
Well, wasn't most knowledge lost and only in the convents and monks with the monks?
Say again?
Wasn't most knowledge lost to the populace and only kept alive in the monasteries?
No, even in the monasteries, they lost all knowledge of Aristotle.
Oh, of Aristotle?
Yeah.
And then when the Renaissance came, his books about him came to light from the...
They came to light when the Moors were kicked out of Spain. And it's the kicking of the Moors out of Spain and all that new knowledge coming into Europe that kicked off the Renaissance. The new knowledge that Western Europe had forgotten.
I thought the Renaissance was kicked off also by the money flooding into Europe and causing the increase in trade, and therefore a money economy developed, and the peasants were starting to be pushed off the land because they couldn't make the money, and then in Italy, with the development of this banking and international trade, the prestigious people gave, you know, all this excess wealth that they had to the creation of the Renaissance. And at the same time, these wealthy people wanted those books from before the Dark Ages. They wanted them. They paid money for them. They had libraries. There would be people that would go out specifically to find those books because they could sell them. You know, be the emissary to these wealthy people who wanted those books of Aristotle and Plato and all that. I thought that was more what happened.
Well, I think did happen, but those books had to come from somewhere, and those books came from Spain, as I understand it initially.
Oh.
That all knowledge had been lost of Aristotle. Aristotle had been expunged from the West European memory and active consciousness. And also, as Europe's economy was developing at the time, you also needed the Roman legal system. They also discovered the Roman legal system came out of Spain, and I believe, I may be wrong in this, but as I recall, they also rediscovered double entry bookkeeping in Spain. And a legal system of the sophistication of Rome, and an accounting system as solid as double entry bookkeeping was needed for the economic growth.
You know, I agree. I remember reading about how, and I think it's in the chapters in the PowerPoint, how the universities in Spain had knowledge. They weren't part of the Dark Ages, from her preface. The Renaissance was a time of creative energy, enthusiasm, expanding horizons, collaborative enterprises, bravura, entrepreneurialism, and intellectual excitement. One of the unexpected outcomes of writing the present book has been the way in which those around me who have given me so much support and encouragement have replicated the exhilarating sense of discovery. Okay, hold on. Okay. The term Renaissance prompts a litany of names of famous artists. It also evokes a particular kind of timeless achievement. This golden era, bathed in perpetual Mediterranean sunlight, was a period of rebirth, as we all know. And we tie it in with the recovery of the ancient languages. Her summary somewhere. The meticulous visual inventory of consumer goods that you see in the Renaissance paintings is not merely a record of inquisitiveness limited to Italy. The Virgin Mary's surroundings gathered together desirable material possessions from across the globe. They announced with pride Italian access to markets from northern France to the Ottoman Empire. Here's a world which assembles with delight rugs from Istanbul, tapestry hangings from Arras, delicate glass from Venice, metalwork from Islamic Spain, porcelain and silk from China, broadcloth from London. The artist has represented with loving care the covetable commodities which by the mid-15th century could be procured with ready money. So she's very aware of that. She calls it, they celebrated global mercantilism. Anyway, I'm not thinking that it's, everything came from Spain. That's what I'm thinking, you know, in terms of Aristotle and whatever. I think that there were these Renaissance people, the wealthy, wanted those books, and they paid a lot of money for them, and they would people would go around to the monasteries to find them also.
But I think the essential for me, the essential point is how the control of the money system by Byzantium plunged Western Europe into centuries of the mother of all depressions. The Dark Ages was literally created by
I totally agree.
That for me is just one of those mind-blowing things. You know, I studied the Dark Ages in high school. And nobody had said that. It was all somehow rather caused by the collapse of Rome, blah blah blah, and influx of Huns, and who knows what else. But in fact, the people like the Visigoths and things actually became basically Roman. So if they became Roman, the people who sacked Rome, then how is it that Western Europe fell into the Dark Ages if people who had already sacked Rome were basically Roman anyway? It never made any sense to me until we went through this and they said that it was literally a chronic shortage of money that lasted centuries that caused the Dark Ages.
Right.
I thought it was because they were homosexual.
Who was homosexual? the emperor at Byzantium? No, I mean, the other way.
Alexander the Great was.
Say it louder.
Alexander the Great was homosexual.
Yeah.
I totally agree, Martin, with what you said, and it's really very important. But add to it, what was going on in the money system of the Empire of Rome that caused this crumbling, right?
They changed the gold standard. They changed the gold standard.
They went to gold and silver commodity money, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that caused the collapse of the Roman Republic. And we ended up with a nightmare of the Roman Empire.
Yeah. So it was money coming from both sides.
There was a different attitude. In the old system, people had loyalty to their tribe, their culture, their society, and they fought for it, and that was the most important thing, to belong to that tribe. And then when Christianity came through, and they're all talking about life hereafter, they focused on life hereafter, and they just divorced themselves from what was going on in the world of economics and business and how they lived. That was one of the explanations in the decline and fall of the Roman Empire.
Can you repeat that again? Because I'm sorry, my mind went out the window.
Close the window, Don.
Before Christianity, people were focused on their identity as members of a tribe or a culture that was in the present. And they were loyal to it, and they fought for it to defend themselves against each other. But when Christianity came along, everybody concentrated on life hereafter and what you had to do to go to heaven instead of hell. And they just didn't pay attention to what was going on in the current world. They neglected it.
And that was from the rise and fall of the Roman Empire?
It's in that, and it's also in somewhere else in some other books, too.
I'll add to that based on reading Stephen's book.
He probably discussed that too at that time.
Well, what he talks about and mentions a couple times is even before Christianity, the Eastern cults, this is like 300 BC.
Zoroastrianism was an early version of Christianity.
Right. The Eastern cults came in to the West, and they also pulled people into, you know, the individual. What am I feeling? You know, mm-hmm. What's my relationship to
my higher power?
To a higher power, and blah, blah. And that also pulled people away from being members of a republic.
Yeah. Well, they didn't have any republic. They're all kings or emperors or something.
Well, the republic lasted till Julius Caesar in 50-something B.C.
Yeah, that was an exception.
But it was...
Oh, it was an exception in Greece.
Yeah. But that was one thing. And also, what you're making me think about is... I just had a thought. Let me just get it. That with the changeover in the type of money from a fiat money during the Republic, say 400 to 300 BC, right? But this very strong Republic it went on until Julius Caesar became the first emperor. But that was a fiat money. No one knows for sure, but we had the 19 reasons from Del Mar of why the Republic's money, the brass money, was a fiat money. So we had that. And then we had the Punic Wars with Carthage, the Carthage Wars.
Carthaginian
Wars. And you had the money changing into a commodity, gold and silver money, right? So
yes.
Right. So again, you have to look at the money, right? And how it and what that did was towards the end of the Republic, you had the growth of these large latifundia with and people were now not owning their own little piece of land. Yeah. They were slaves.
Yeah.
You know, the ordinary Roman was either a dead slave or a real slave, right? Mm-hmm. So what kind of republic can you have when the people are the people? Why would they want to support this republic and give their lives for it when they're being held in debt and slavery?
Yeah.
Well, they have certain protections and rights that were covered by the people who owned.
You have to say it louder, not just to me.
They had certain protections and certain rights as serfs. If they were loyal to the, what do you call it, a knight or whoever, that he had to protect them. But they had to volunteer to go to war for him, too, when he had trouble with any other people, or any other knights or kings. It was reciprocal. They were given some protections if they supported the person that owned it.
But that's in the going towards after the empire is gone. No, 400.
Yeah, gradually.
AD.
Gradually, those things evolved.
Yeah. I mean, Stephen is so brilliant if you just keep looking at the money. Oh, my God.
Well, the empire, the empire was when they had the gold and silver standard. Is that also when they were occupying England?
Yeah.
And I tell you, the reason I ask this is I was looking on Google Earth the other day at a train station, and you know how the street view goes, and over across the way was the Tower of London. Well, around the Tower of London is a Roman a wall that was built.
Ah.
I was wondering when that was built. I mean, there was, the wall is still there, and it's a Roman wall, And I was wondering if that was built under the empire or the republic.
Let's see. I'm doing a Google, a search on the internet. Roman Britain is the name given to the areas of the island of Great Britain that were governed by the Roman Empire from AD 43 to 409.
Okay, so that was during the gold standard things. It was the empire, not the republic.
Right. It says here, Julius Caesar invaded Britain in 55 and 54 B.C. as part of his Gallic Wars.
Gallic?
Gallic. Gallic.
Garlic for me.
That's my Brooklyn accent.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was the empire.
Whatever he did, I know he didn't succeed in England.
So it was Julius Caesar.
Yeah, Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
But there were a string of other related families related to him in the ensuing years after he died.
You know, I'm having the thought that it would be good to find someone to do this book again, go over it with a group of people again, and even solidify the ideas even more, you know, to make it shorter and more crisp. Because it's so much material you forget from the past.
Well, when you're doing that, you should put it in chronological order in the first chapters, too.
Oh, yeah, that was... So this is the other question I have. I have two questions. The third one is, how could you improve the book? That's, or any other thoughts you have about the book, whether how to improve it, what you like about it, or any other thoughts about the class that would be helpful. Because I'm feeling right now that I need to go back and review it with a group of people.
The part about fractional reserve banking, and I think you could do away with that chart that's in there, and pick up more what Steve King says about when the money's created, the reserves are created.
When the money is created, what is created?
The reserves.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, the reserves are created at the same time.
But where do we talk about the fractional reserve?
I don't remember the chapter. He's got a chart in here.
The book? Let me see the book.
We've lost Martin, and I don't know for how long.
Oh, there it is on the end, the top shelf.
Oh, here it is. Fractional reserve. Let's see what's... I don't remember Stephen having that chart in there.
There was a chart about... Hell. What? Does he not have an index? There it is.
Okay. Yeah, he has an index. Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Look at my book.
Probably around... system. Oh, probably around 637.
Okay.
What was that chart?
You sure you didn't see it in another book?
It's kind of showed the stair staff thing.
I might have it in the PowerPoint. But I don't think I would. I don't like that chart. I don't think I would have put it in the PowerPoint.
Yeah. Well, I don't see it in that chapter. Oh, well, that's the European Monetary System. What the hell am I doing there?
Yeah, I think you might have saw it in another book.
Maybe so. I think it was in here.
But Stephen doesn't like that chart.
Yeah.
Why?
This is not true. Yeah.
Because it is not true. Well, I don't see. Yeah. Because whenever you look for something in a book, you can never find it right off.
I think the book needs. The book needs. Each chapter needs like a crisp summary.
Oh.
And he doesn't have that. You have to read the whole chapter in order to understand, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe at the beginning of each chapter, you know, summary, what you're going to learn in this chapter. What do you think?
Add the book. Fractional reserve, the definition?
No. At the beginning of each chapter, add a summary of what.
Oh, yeah. He has a summary at the end.
Where does he have a summary at the end?
I think it's in his book. Every chapter has a summary at the end.
Where?
I don't remember
that. This is my other question. How do you make our class materials more accessible to ordinary people? But they're huge. You know?
Summarizing Rome's Law Monetary Experience, how important reasons are lessons.
Are you saying this to everybody?
Well, at the end of chapter 3, there's a summary on the two pages before chapter 4, page 105, what Rome teaches us about money.
Ah, so summarizing. You should put them in the front, no?
I don't know. Because
he does have an epilogue in each chapter, you're right.
Conclusion over the Muslim ratio.
So he's got, at the end of the chapter, he sort of does a couple paragraphs of a summary after each chapter. But I'm feeling it should be in the front of the chapter.
Okay. If you want to get through the book quickly, just go to the summary.
Well, that's one way of doing it.
Yeah.
You know? Or you could take the PowerPoints and try to really cut them down, though. They have all the, you know, it's what ideas do you pick out from all of Stephen's ideas? Because he gives a lot of flesh, you know? It's tricky. I've never done something like that.
Well, they don't have a definite summary. It must be another book I'm reading.
What do you think, Will?
I don't know. I mean, we've got thousands of years of history in here.
That's right.
And it's important, all of it is, to give a basis for understanding what's going on now. I mean, all of it is.
Oh, my God, you're so right.
Yeah.
But look at positive money. It doesn't really go back into that history at all.
No, and I think they're going to get lost because of it. I think positive money is going to get bamboozled.
Oh, because they don't know the history?
Because of the bankers, the things that Bank of England is doing. I think positive money is going to get put off on a dirt road and not require all the things that need to be done. Although they put out a Facebook post this morning. Just a second. I'm copying all of my American Monetary. There it did. It just finished it off of my old hard drive onto my new hard drive. Well, I don't see the positive money proposed, but it was the three reasons. Three things that need to be done, and it was similar to nationalize the Federal Reserve, deal away with fractional reserve banking, and spend money in the economy. It was similar, but it wasn't exactly like that.
Yeah. I mean, how much closer can you get to the NEED Act?
Yeah.
Have the U.S. government spend the money into infrastructure from England.
Say that again.
You could have the Englishmen fund all the infrastructure improvements in the United States.
Yeah.
And reparations from what they did in the Revolution.
I mean, I find it mind-boggling that positive money basically is presenting the NEED Act.
Yeah.
And they're doing it without all the history that is in Stephen's book.
Yeah.
And they seem to be reaching some influential people as well as, you know, ordinary people.
I haven't read that.
So my question is, to have monetary reform, do you really need 7,000 years of history?
Yes, you do. That's my argument. You can get bamboozled if you don't know it.
Yeah, you can get led astray. Sooner or later, you're going to get something you don't know.
I think everybody needs to know the history, but some people involved in the monetary reform movement definitely do need to know the history.
Yeah.
So they can pull others back when they come off the rails.
Oh, that's such a good point, because I've always had the thought that if you don't know the history of how they waylaid the reforms in the past, you know, with the Farmers Alliance, they were very clear on money. That was their focus, really. It wasn't farming. Their movement was really focused on changing the money system, and they went off into silver, and then the movement died.
Yeah,
you know, and that's something to learn from them. They said, oh, well, you know, our third party, the Populist Party, needs to fuse with the Democratic Party, or else we won't get anybody into office. We don't have enough votes, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And that was sort of the beginning of the end of them.
That's the same old argument that's being used. You should go to vote for Hillary.
What's that argument to vote for her?
Because Bernie won't make it. If you vote for Bernie, you're gonna elect Donald Trump.
Oh yes.
Yeah. It's the same argument. Yeah.
Oh, so maybe that's why they put Donald Trump forward. For that reason.
To scare people into voting for Hillary.
That's right. That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Wow.
You got it's fine.
Wow.
Yeah.
Martin, we were just talking about my last and final question, which is last thoughts about the book itself and just about the class and or just about monetary reform. That's what we're talking about.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, for me personally, I mean, I just think the book is amazing. And actually, so were your presentations too.
Oh, thank you.
I added so much to the book.
Yes.
I mean, just an incredible amount to the book. And that took a lot of work on your part. That's just amazing.
I was amazed too. You know, when you fall in love with something, uh-huh, it has an amazing feeling.
Yeah.
You're inspired.
Yeah. Yeah.
But for me, the book is so comprehensive. And it is, I mean, a remarkable piece of book. That actually, some of the basic themes of the book, and some of the important points of the book, are actually somewhat buried by the sheer scope and scale of its subject matter and the size of the book itself.
Right. So how could you rectify that? Not you, but people. How could that be rectified?
I think we've been doing that somewhat. We've been trying to pull out the essential themes of the book. I think Stephen made a mistake in chapter 2 about the Roman money system. He was trying in the chapter to prove that he was trying to prove an academic point, which was, you know, important and actually had to be made. It was central to the actual whole treatment of the Roman money system, but I think much of that should have been put into an appendix. And, you know, that made chapter 2. To me, chapter 2 was the hardest read of all.
Yeah.
And there was stuff in there that he was getting into that the technical details supporting his point that I think should have been put in an appendix and have been referenced.
Was that all about the ratios of money?
No, there was all kinds of things.
Yeah, which was really hard to follow.
I mean, that's my biggest criticism of the book is actually chapter 2. And it's chapter 2, it's early on in the book, and I think it really is a deterrent to even reading the whole book.
I agree. That's a very good point. Very good. Yeah, and he, at the beginning of the chapter, he says, I want to apologize to my readers. That I'm going to do this.
No, don't do it. In the appendix, it's summarize the conclusions.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I was very confused. I'm not good at all with understanding exchange rates between different kinds of money.
Yeah.
Forget it. My mind goes out the door, out the window. Yeah. Yeah.
The window.
The window.
Not pointed toward the window.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's something else too. I mean, this is my take on the rise of fractional reserve banking and how it is that it became accepted. He gets into it, but I don't think he emphasizes. I mean, it's in there, but he doesn't emphasize for me what is the key point about how is it the bankers could get away with this, and that is that because at that time money was tied to gold, limited the money supply, and the European economy really needed more money. And by they invented fractional reserve banking through their own greed, but it did expand the money supply, and that was actually quite important. And for me, that's why the bankers got away with it at that time.
If the engines of production keep going, then anything can be money. Money is what people believe they need to do things. As they exchange it, and what was I going to say? No matter if it's gold or not, the gold has got nothing to do with it, really. Silver has nothing to do with it. Paper is almost worthless in itself. It's just the promise that somebody else will do certain things for you, make things for you, or run a service for you, whatever. It's nonsense to think that gold is the answer to the problem. It's not. It's got nothing to do with the problem.
Well, I think it
shines, that's all.
Can I just say something?
I think it's tied to gold is how fractional reserve banking, tying money to gold, is how fractional reserve banking was accepted.
Was it accepted because there was enough people willing to accept the money, no matter whether it was real money there or gold or anything else, they were willing to accept the money as the real thing.
Yeah.
They knew they'd get paid
and
get something for their money.
That's the point that the bankers started getting away with murder.
Yeah.
I think what empowered them to do that is because when the money started flooding into Europe and it became a money economy, not the individual manners independent of each other, basically, with not that much trade going on. But you had this upsurge of trade internationally coming into Europe. The bankers, you know, I think it was somewhere very early on, they learned how to, and I have to find out how early, it's in this book somewhere, how to use their ledgers. Because I remember, and I think it's in the PowerPoints, the bankers, no one could understand really, in the Middle Ages, the later Middle Ages, about the bankers, because no one was allowed to look at their ledgers, and who what ordinary person could understand these little marks on the ledgers. So you have the bankers poring over the ledgers, but not letting other people in on this, and so they could manipulate. It was the counting money. That's what it was. And the beginning of the accounting system, somewhere in this book, I have somewhere on my C drive the history of the accounting system. And the first man who documented it, wrote a book about it, was like around 1500. But it was being used before. It was being used by the Venetian bankers. So they were already creating accounting money. No, and no one could understand their system. They wouldn't let anybody really learn their system. They weren't going to tell
you. And nobody cares either, as long as they get their money's worth for the money.
Nobody.
Point, but what? But weren't there some people who actually did understand it? For example, as I recall from Stephen's book, that the Hanseatic League around the Baltic, of German states and other states, actually really opposed the bankers creating money.
Right,
really,
the credit.
They
called it the credit, right? They didn't want credit. They wanted real gold and silver. That's That's what they use. They didn't agree with these, you know, bills of, what do they call them? Bills of, back then, for international trade. They were just, you know, written with the name on it and, you know, promissory notes for international trade, to pay for international
trade. Bill of exchange.
What?
A bill of exchange.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right? We remember that at the fairs in Europe.
Shipping back and forth.
Shipping back and forth. And selling and buying and selling back and forth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Remember in the fairs in Europe during the later Middle Ages, they were exchanging their credit, you know, in their bills of exchange and netting the money. But it was all accounting money. It was all, you know, these promissory notes. And I think that's the Hanseatic League just wanted gold and silver. They wanted to see the money. You know, they didn't want this thing they called credit.
Could have done it with paper, too.
I think,
not very well.
Let me look in Stephen's book, if that's where I found it.
There's a chapter on the Hanseatic.
Yeah.
Pretty
see
near
what
the front.
It, what he says. He's the, let me see. Hanseatic League. But I was, you know, I was, when I first learned that Alexander Hamilton had written this report as the first Secretary of Treasury to the Congress in 1791, and in the report explained all about accounting money and moving it, you know, moving it around and saying, isn't it delightful that we can do all of these transactions and the real money never leaves the bank and it just goes around and around, you know? And I went, what? He wrote it right in there. But it goes back to the Middle Ages, this accounting money, you know? Let me say Hanseatic, H-A, Hanseatic League. Yeah, I see it. 169.
Wait, I thought it was a whole chapter.
Let's see what he says here. He's giving a lot of descriptions. The Hansa had no monetary powers, had no formal legal status except its General Assembly. But he had no monetary powers whatever, a fact that argues against the assumption that money was originated by merchants. The Hansa were unable to envisage the unification of the various money systems, even though various currencies were a serious obstacle to their commerce. And the most widely used currencies were the mark, the pound, Flemish pound, and English pound sterling. So I think they were, I have to reread this, but I think they were dealing with currency, you know, with the real thing that you put in your hand, you know. Let's see. The great 150-year war against credit. Yeah. From about 1400, a major battle raged between the Hanseatic League along with the House of Burgundy using a cash-based trading system. They wanted cash. They didn't want any of these bills of exchange or anything.
Promises, promises, promises.
Yeah. I mean, anyway.
I forgot all about that.
The Hanseatics were alarmed by the Italians' command of credit. They met them at Cologne as moneylenders and at the Champagne fairs and then at Brugge, England, and Frankfurt. The Hansa recognized the financial power of the Italians and their superior commercial techniques. So they were afraid of credit.
They didn't. Mafioso down there.
Right. Well, they were afraid because they knew it could be, they
you know, beat them out,
it could beat them out because they could manipulate.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. They were abolishing credit transactions. Rubeck forbade for 3 years all buying and selling on credit with foreigners in Flanders. All imported goods had to be accompanied by a certificate saying that they had been bought in Flanders for cash. But they didn't win. Yeah. They didn't win. Yeah. So interesting. Mm. So there is this book that I got. I don't know where it is. I think it might even be just on the internet. And it's the history of double entry accounting.
And
it came from
two sets of books.
The late Middle Ages.
Two sets of books.
Yeah, I came across it, and I just I said I have to have that. It's a history of double entry bookkeeping.
Yeah.
You know.
Not two sets of books.
And it's, you know. But they always had their ledgers, even before this double... And I think the double entry system came from the Muslims, now that I'm remembering. Came from the Muslims.
That's right.
Well, I believe it actually goes back to the classical times.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but the Muslims... I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I actually thought Rome had double entry bookkeeping. And the Muslims preserved it while it got lost in Europe during the Dark Ages.
Well, they kept on going with it. Yeah.
Oh, that might be true. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to look.
It's in the book. I think I saw something about it.
Double entry. You want to look?
Yeah.
I'm just going to go see if I can. I think it's one of the sources that I have for the our class. Let me see. I go here. What chapter would that be in? Double entry bookkeeping.
Here we go.
I guess that's what I need to know. Double entry bookkeeping. Renaissance struggles for monetary supremacy. Maybe there. Renaissance struggles. Let's see.
God. Heavens. Muslims. 95-96. Hold on. And Christians. And Crusades. Monetary system. That one? I think that's page.
Does it say double entry?
No, but monetary system might be it.
Yeah.
100.
No, you want the.
Oh, no, the numbers are over there. 137.
Yeah.
140. Earlier, 132, 135.
I don't know if it's in Stephen's book about
it's
double.
It's over here. I just gave it. You don't have to look on the place. I'll find it. 137 to 140.
Look at it. Let's look for it. I'm going to look under sources because I'm pretty sure I copied it down. But what I put it understands. Now, I have to find it. But it's really fascinating. But even before double entry, I mean, double entry is a very specific thing. They were using accounts, right, and writing things and being very secretive about it. And no one really understood what they were doing, you know, that they were creating money. I just knew they could get...
Stephen says on page 157 that the Knights Templar that bought double entry bookkeeping back to Europe from the Crusades.
There you go. And that's early.
Did you find it in the book?
Yeah, the 1300s here.
Were they the 1300s?
Yeah.
The Knights Templar? They were the 1200s, weren't they?
No, yeah, I think you're right. It was 1307 they were suppressed, I think.
Yeah. So that's the 13th century, right?
Yeah.
Double entry bookkeeping. that early.
11th century.
And I'll tell you,
10,000.
I'm at the bank today, and I'm looking at the double entry bookkeeping, and boy, you can do whatever you want with it. That's what the bank does. I'll tell you that they have all these different accounts, and they just move it, the accounting entries around, and you're lost. You're lost.
Yeah.
You know?
What are we looking for here? Double entry or
double entry bookkeeping? No, double entry bookkeeping. But Martin just found it.
What was page was it on?
What page, Martin?
157.
Oh,
further back. Good. The money, medieval money lenders.
Yes, it's in there, in the second paragraph. That's it.
Here.
Yeah. Knights Templar.
Here it is. Read that out.
The Templars brought double entry bookkeeping back from the Crusades, and the Italians were among the first to master it. De Ruyter notes that in all centers, the great Italian banking houses were the principal lenders and practically dominated the money markets. The importance of the Jewish moneylenders during the medieval period has been greatly overstated, except perhaps in England.
De Ruyter, I think that book, I think I read a good part of that book. He's very, very good.
Yeah.
That guy. Yeah, you know, this credit money has been around since the Knights Templar, but it was... I don't know what they did, the Muslims did with it, if they were manipulating their cultures with it, you know, but maybe they, with their religion, they didn't do as much, you know. Maybe they were, had more humane bankers. Yeah, I mean, they had double entry bookkeeping before we did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, guys, this was great.
Yeah.
And it's been wonderful. I'm going to take all of the ideas and suggestions and think about them. And I'll be in touch about them. I don't know when, but because it's just too important to end our study here, you know.
I was thinking that sooner or later we've got to start preparing petitions for monetary reform, but we got a long way to go because nobody would know what we're talking about probably for another 5-10 years of constant articles on it being mm-hmm. published somewhere, and the internet's the best place to start putting things. But I don't think
we can make a simple petition, and people will sign them. They didn't.
Too soon for petition.
Say it louder.
I think it's got to explain it to more and more people, so that they'll all sign. Because the banks are going to do something else to cut us out.
What about your idea about articles? Like, would anybody in our group want to write short articles, and then we could publish them? I could get them probably published if we have this website for Greens, you know.
Let's start there.
Short articles, just, you know. Hey, Martin, thank you so much for your thought. They're just very, make you want to think a whole lot. Thank you.
Well, I could say about everything that you've done in this class.
Thank you.
They make you rethink.
Well, there was something I wanted to bring.
Bye, and it's truly been great.
Oh, bye. What?